morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome back to those who've been wherever you've been over the summer, traveling or spending time with family, hopefully outdoors. We had some really good time outdoors. It's starting to feel a little bit like fall, a little bit like turning, you know, okay, refocusing the energies a little bit. So we thought, as a kind of lead-in to our practice period, which will be starting at the end of the month, every year we have a 6 to 8 week practice period where we kind of intensify and strengthen our practice. And each person does that in their own way. You can kind of customize the practice period for yourself. And there's a guide on the website to that to give you information about it. But we thought, as a kind of warm-up, we'd do a back-to-basics series. And Michael started last week, but you're not too late. We're only going to do four. Just looking at some really fundamentals of Buddhist teaching. For those of you who are quite new to practice, maybe it's not back-to-basics, but starting with the foundations. And for those of you who have been practicing for a while, or maybe a long while, it's always good to check the condition of your foundations, right? You know, because it is in the nature of foundations to get a little cracked, a little eroded over time, right? You know, with the wear and tear of everyday life in this world. So, I said that, you know, you have the metaphor of a foundation, and then I sort of questioned if the metaphor entirely holds, because the way I actually think of these teachings is more like a scaffolding. In Japan, you see these quite high and large, sometimes, scaffolding made entirely of bamboo. I hope they're still doing it. Entirely of bamboo, lashed with some kind of fiber rope. And the scaffolding sometimes is covers huge big temples when they're replacing a roof, for example. And the scaffolding is both light and flexible in an earthquake, you know, in a tremor, and incredibly strong and resilient. And that's how I think of this structure of the basic Buddhist teachings, is that kind of scaffolding. They are a construct, right? They're just to help us. But a construct that is both elegant and highly serviceable. The Buddha was a great pragmatist. So the structure is a real help upon which to build our practice and find support for life on the path of awakening. And it's worth continually refreshing, you know, what we call our beginner's mind. You know, not making the assumption that we know this already, we know that already. There are always fresh perspectives to be had as we mature in our practice, right? We're not the same person we were 5 or 10 years ago, or even yesterday. So tonight, I want to give you an overview of the Eightfold Path. We could take 8 weeks on the Eightfold Path, one for each aspect, but this is going to be the condensed version. And it's a continuation of Michael's topic last week, which was the Four Noble Truths. Who was here last week? Quite a few, and then quite a few not. So, just to review very briefly, the first noble truth, and many of you know this, the first noble truth is the truth that our lives are marked by dukkha, or suffering, as it's most often translated. Also translated as dissatisfaction. So that covers everything from the most trivial annoyances in our daily lives to the deepest anguish that life can bring. The second noble truth is that there is a cause for this suffering. And the cause is the way we cling to what we want and push away what we don't want. The way we cling to a self-focused view of reality and refuse to see that the nature of existence is impermanent and interdependent, that all phenomena are subject to complex causes and conditions. Things do not always go the way we want. And life is most definitely not always fair. And we suffer in so many ways because of that, because of the way we think it should be. So the third noble truth is that it is possible to be free of suffering. And the fourth is that there's a way or a path to that freedom. And that path is the Eightfold Path. According to the legend of the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path came to him in the final part of his last night sitting in meditation. And they were what he taught in his first Dharma talk after being persuaded to teach by the gods. He was reluctant at first. He thought, people just will never get this. He had to be persuaded to go out and teach. So the Eightfold Path was his first gift to the world, to the Sangha, but it was also his last legacy before he died to the Sangha. Before he died, he reviewed his core teachings. He said, practice this, let these teachings be your teacher now, that I will be gone. There's a story that the very last person the Buddha ordained before he died was a young man named Subhadda, who showed up. The Buddha was very, very ill, and his attendant Ananda tried to turn Subhadda away, saying it would be too exhausting for the Buddha to see you. But the Buddha insisted that the young man should be invited in. Subhadda was a little bit awkward, I think, and he started in asking, there are so many other spiritual teachers around in various places. Are they all fully enlightened? You know, he wanted to make sure he had the right one. And the Buddha replied, don't be preoccupied with evaluating someone else's enlightenment. The question is, do you want to be liberated? If so, practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Wherever the noble Eightfold Path is practiced, joy, peace, and insight are there. This is a good little story to remember if you ever catch someone, perhaps even yourself, holding forth about whether so-and-so is more enlightened than so-and-so. You know, those kind of conversations. And stop and ask that question the Buddha asked Subhadda. Are you willing to be liberated and to do that practice? In the 5th century of the Common Era, we'll take a look at the components of the Eightfold Path. So I've made a handout to help you because I'm going to cram a lot in. There will not be a test other than your everyday life, which provides us with plenty of tests, right? So I gave you this to kind of help you see the structure of the scaffolding. And notice I'm using the word components of the Eightfold Path rather than steps. Because as you'll soon see, it's not a linear path where you have to progress from this step before you can take the next step and the next. These aspects of the Eightfold Path all support each other. They interlock. And you continue, they interlock, interweave, you continue to refine and deepen them over a lifetime of practice. So they'll continue to reveal themselves to you. You know, at one point you might have a kind of academic understanding or an intellectual understanding of them, and then later on you might have a really firsthand experience of one or another and how they support each other. But this is a traditional way of ordering them and of clustering them. In the 5th century of the Common Era, there was a monk named Buddha Ghosha, who wrote a very famous text called the Visuddhimagga, or the Path of Purification, which systematized the teachings that had come from the Buddha at that point in Theravadan, or early Buddhism. And he clustered the Eightfold Path around three categories, which are often called the three teachings or the three practices. So you'll see they are called generally wisdom, morality, and concentration. Wisdom prajna, morality sila, and concentration samadhi. And they form a kind of stable triad for our practice. If one is wobbly, it destabilizes the whole system. Now, if this correlation were really going to hold up well, I guess there would have to be a ninefold path, three in each category, but we'll let that go. They do correlate rather well with the Eightfold Path. So looking first at the first two on the Eightfold Path, right view and right thought, correspond to wisdom. They're how we orient our mind towards the truth of Buddha nature, the true nature of existence. Right view, or sometimes it's called right understanding, is our deep insight into the truth of suffering and its cause. It's our understanding of impermanence and of the non-self nature of all phenomena. When I say non-self nature, I mean that no single phenomenon exists except within a matrix of interconnection with all other phenomena. Michael will say more about this next week. Right thought, the next one, is sometimes also called right intention or right aspiration. It's the way we align our everyday thoughts with our deepest understanding. So we're aware of when our thoughts get distorted. What distorts our thoughts? The three poisons: greed, hatred, or aversion, greed, aversion, and ignorance. Ignorance, turning away. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see the truth. Right? These are our habit patterns, deeply ingrained habit patterns of self-focused responses to the world around us. And so we become aware of when our thoughts are disordered, distorted, and we deliberately turn our thoughts towards our best intentions, our aspirations to live with kindness, compassion, wisdom, patience, skillful means, all generosity, all those qualities that a bodhisattva cultivates. The great Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh gives us four practices that support this part of the Eightfold Path: right thought, right intention. First is when you become aware of a kind of rigidity in yourself, a judgmental fear or aversion-based thoughts. When your attention comes to such a state arising, whether it's directed towards yourself or someone else, you stop, breathe, and ask yourself, are you sure? Are you sure? You know, maybe you heard the expression somewhere, don't believe your thoughts, don't be so sure, don't believe your thoughts, always. Because these kinds of thoughts, these distorted thoughts, are always partial, never the whole picture, and they're always provisional, they're subject to change. They're not the whole truth in all its complexity, and if we can recognize that, we can begin to let go of our rigid clinging to our own self-interested attitudes and open our heart and mind to a more spacious view. you might protest, that's not just my opinion, it's the truth. All the more reason to question yourself. All the more reason to say, are you sure? The second practice Thich Nhat Hanh gives is to stop and ask yourself, what am I doing? Right now, bring the focus to right now, this moment. You might notice how you are harming yourself and others. Or you might notice how right now you're feeding that obsessive thought. As you're feeding that obsessive thought, you're missing a moment of incredible beauty right before your eyes. What am I doing? The third practice he gives is being present with your own habitual energies and patterns, meeting them, facing them, with a kind of friendliness. You know, not beating yourself up, just saying, hello. Hello, habit pattern. Oh, yeah, that one, I know you. Just looking. Looking clearly, with your Dharma eye, your clear Dharma eye. Hello, worry. It's you again. Hello, envy. Stopping and feeling, looking into the insubstantiality of each of these states. Are they really true? No, they're contracted, they're partial. And they're conditioned, born of causes and conditions, just like a thunderstorm is born of causes and conditions. It arises and subsides. So then the fourth practice Thich Nhat Hanh gives is pausing to connect with something called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta, bodhi is awakening and citta is mind, so the mind of awakening. And it refers to the realization or the understanding that we do not awaken alone as individuals. And it's the aspiration to awaken, aspiration together with the understanding that we awaken together with and for all other beings. You know, it's not our personal self-improvement project to awaken. So that arising, once that feeling, awareness of bodhicitta has arisen in our hearts, it's a powerful antidote to all deluded states. So we really need to kind of invoke it in our hearts. So as you can start to see, right view and right thought directly support our capacity then to actualize our practice in our everyday lives in the world. And those are the next three aspects of the Eightfold Path, which cluster around morality. So our thoughts condition our speech, right? How many of you rehearse conversations or rehash conversations in your mind? We do it a lot. And so we condition our minds, then that conditions our speech. And our speech strongly conditions how we behave, our actions. So notice that speech gets its very own place on the Eightfold Path. And you'll also notice when you become acquainted with the precepts that are called the grave precepts, there are 10 of them in the set that we use, that three of those concern speech and language. So I think that is a testimony to how much trouble speech gets us, you know, our words get us into. They get us into a lot of trouble. Speech and language are relatively new in our millions of years of evolution as living beings. So, you know, our words are really quite unreliable and often faulty, often inaccurate. And yet, as human beings, we are distinctly creatures of language, and language has a great power and beauty when used well and with care. So we need to pay attention to how we use it. So here are some of the guidelines for right speech. Use true rather than false speech. That's pretty obvious. Use kind rather than harsh, angry, bitter speech. Use respectful rather than demeaning speech. Using speech that connects rather than divides. That's a big one for our times right now to consider. Using speech that is significant rather than trivial or gossipy. It's a lot to practice right there, isn't it? That's a pretty significant cluster. But then, of course, our thoughts and our words extend even further to our behavior. So right action is summed up by the practice of the precepts. Traditionally, monks and nuns vowed to observe over 300 precepts. But lay people, a couple thousand years ago in the time of the Buddha, lay people would receive the five basic precepts. Even then, lay people could receive the precepts, and they would typically receive five. And those are not intentionally or carelessly harming living beings, not taking what is not given, so that's not killing, not stealing, right? Not speaking falsely, not misusing sexuality, and not using substances or activities that are addictive or cloud the mind. So that's using wording that we use in our Soto Zen tradition. Both monastics and lay people receive the same set of 16 precepts. There's not a big divide between the ordained and the lay people. And when you take up the practice of these precepts, you discover that they are not just black and white rules, good and bad, with a sharp line down the middle. They are inexhaustible mindfulness practices. They are deep koans, deep questions that help us penetrate the central dilemma of self and other. It's like sort of the core human question, isn't it? So when our thoughts, our speech, and our actions are aligned with our view of the Dharma and our intentions, we naturally want our livelihood to be in alignment too. So we come to right livelihood. We're motivated to avoid any occupation that causes harm and suffering to other living beings, or any kind of work that leads to our own inner deterioration. To earn a living in an honest, harmless, and peaceful way. That's not so easy, is it, in this world, where we are implicated so deeply in systems that do harm. Systems that do harm to those with less power and fewer resources, and to non-human species, and to the earth systems on which our very lives depend. So again, there's not a neat and tidy way to proceed. We have to be able to hold a great deal of complexity and still make decisions and still align our lives with our best, our highest aspirations. So we need all the help we can get, really, I think, from Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three treasures, to find our way forward. And we need the last section of the Eightfold Path, which is the practice of meditation, to help us. The first of that set of three is right effort. And the classic analogy for right effort is the string on a stringed instrument, right? If it's too tight, it'll snap. If it's too loose or slack, it won't sound, or it'll sound terrible. You can observe this very closely, just even in your own zazen practice. If you're straining too hard, you end up getting in your own way. And when you're going slack and not really paying attention, you're not, you're not fully engaging the practice, right? So with experience, you learn when to ramp up your energy a bit, and even in how you attend to your breath and your body, when to kind of brighten that or intensify that effort or energy, and when to ease up and sit with a very gentle spaciousness. This ability to kind of titrate your effort, your right effort, becomes very important. I mean, you can really observe it when you're doing a longer retreat in the course of a week, or even in the span of a day. You have to make those adjustments. It's also really important when you're struggling with rough patches in your life, with very intense emotional states. You need to adjust the effort that you're putting into your practice more or less in a way that is sustaining. Then, of course, there's mindfulness, right? Cultivating moment-to-moment awareness of body and mind. Grounding ourselves in awareness of our breath and bodily sensations, extending that awareness to mind content, thoughts, emotions, memories, plans, daydreams, as they arise and subside. Mindfulness has become a pop culture buzzword. I was just in a Save-On today with a friend, and right there in glossy, full color, at the checkout, published by Time magazine, was the new mindfulness. And that's not a bad thing, but mindfulness can only go so far without the other elements of the Eightfold Path, and without the other key component of meditation practice, which is right concentration. Concentration is the capacity to keep the attention focused without being distracted by every little stimulus produced by our environment or by our mind. And we need this basic stability to be able to attend to that flow of our experience, which is why most meditation teachers start by teaching some form of concentration practice, most often focusing on the breath, or sometimes a mantra or phrase from a koan. But in the core Soto Zen practice that we do, called Shikantaza, which means just sitting, if we become too narrowly focused or tensely focused on breath concentration, we lose out on that spacious field of awareness within which we can really give attention to what arises in the full scope of our experience. And that is what we can take into our daily life. We can be too attached to a kind of tense micromanagement of our practice. With experience and sometimes some guidance from a teacher, we can learn to calibrate how to balance these three: right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. We need all three, but we need them to be in balance, in proportion. And that can vary with circumstances. It's not always the same. So that's how you can learn to be skillful in your practice. So I think by now you can see that these eight aspects are interdependent. They're not linear. Each supports the other, and that's why they're represented, as you can see on your handout, by the eight spokes of the Dharma wheel. And if one wheel is broken, the wheel will start to wobble. If three are out of kilter, you might just crash. If our everyday behavior, you know, our right speech and our right action, our speech and action, if are chaotic and confused and harmful, it will be very hard to establish a strong, steady meditation practice. If we only focus on achieving mastery of meditation, techniques, without extending our awareness to every aspect of our life, our practice will be unbalanced in that way, and we're likely to develop blind spots, perhaps vulnerable to lapses in ethical behavior because we think we're such great meditators that that doesn't really apply to us. You know? And if our view and thoughts remain in the realm of abstract philosophical concepts, we'll be unable to actualize our practice right where the rubber hits the road, when times get tough. So I hope that you are appreciating more just what a comprehensive scaffolding the Buddha has offered us here, and how you might make it more personally familiar to your practice and your everyday life. So while we still have a few minutes, not many, I fell into talking too long. A lot to cram in. What I'd like you to do is, you know, and you can use your handouts to help, is look at what aspect or aspects of the Eightfold Path you find particularly challenging in your life as it's configured right now. And then what other aspect of the Eightfold Path would be of support and help balance that challenging aspect. That sounds abstract, but I think you can probably think of examples. Rather than get in groups of threes, which we like to do, I'm just going to ask you to pair up. I don't know if that'll be... find a partner near you, just in pairs, and each talk for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes each on this. And really, when it's your turn to listen, just listen to the other person. So it's not a discussion so much as each person really attending, you know, speaking and listening from the heart. Okay? So that means also then we speak in confidence that we won't bring up what the other person has said afterwards at tea or elsewhere. How's that?
Introduce yourselves.
And please introduce yourselves to each other.
Are you going to keep time?
Yeah, I will keep time. So I'll give you each about 3 minutes. So, yeah?
Could you just repeat the question?
The question is, what aspect of the Eightfold Path do you find particularly challenging? Is there one or two, you know, that you find difficult? And then what about the other aspects of the Eightfold Path would support you in balancing or strengthening that one that's more challenging? Okay? So see if you can find just one other person.